Jeffries was to hold a meeting in the Lucy Thurman Y.
And of course, that doesn't exist anymore.
But he was mayor at the time, and he was holding a meeting, and we were told to be there. But we were Pat Quinn was requested to send a secretary with a steno, you know, to take the minutes of the meeting. And we went down, she and I went downstairs, and we tried to get a cab, and no cab would take us the others across Bluebird. And while we were arguing with a cab driver about big pot-bellied, you know, cat came with it and had a ball bat. And he started jabbing me with it. And, you know,
you didn't know you were the representative of the labor movement.
No, he couldn't care less either at that point. He was, you know, a real redneck type that was anxious, and he was trying to provoke me. And I kept in mind one thing Pat said to me, Brad, God, get there. I don't give a damn how you do it, but get there. It's important that we get there. So I said to the secretary, and I had her name when I came into my camera, you know, I do this. She's still alive and living in Stratford, Ontario. She must be 100 years old. Because she was 10 or 20 years older than me. She was a very courageous woman. But we started walking across. We walked. And we came to, you know, it was very tense, and neither of us were trying to play any heroics. We were trying to, you know, fulfill this mission that we had been assigned.
Where were you confronted by this man with the bat?
Oh, that was on Woodward Avenue, and we were trying to get a cab and arguing with the cab driver about it, you know. So we took off, and I didn't, you know, get into it with him or anything. I just walked away with her, and he pursued us a bit, but he, you know, someone else said, I'll leave him alone. So, but we walked across, and I think it was Adelaide, though I'm not certain. But I remember we were having some, there was some, you know, people, young people especially, that were kind of excited in a sense. I guess it was kind of brazen, or it was perceived as being brazen. But tried to explain and so on. Anyway, we went by a porch, and there were a number of people on the blank, all black. This was an all black situation. And someone on the porch made a comment. Said, but we're friends of the Negro people. Negro was the operational word at that time. You know, we didn't use, we had just got out of the business of talking about color, and we began to use the term Negro. And this one woman went into a rage because she interpreted that as the eye. It was really a tense situation, and I said, please, no matter what anyone says, let's not, you know, let's get to the Lucy Thurman line. We got there and the meeting was canceled. I don't know when.
Did you get a purple star anyway?
But that was, you know, that experience was a revelation to me more than just an intellectual exercise. I knew then what most black people had been encountering all their lives. And you began to reflect on the whole proposition. So, and it was shortly after I went in service, and like you, totally segregated situation, you know. But I had endless quarrels in service about that my experiences with people in the trade union movement, black people that I encountered, and my experiences, because we began living in neighborhoods that were changing, and there was more than just the desire to raise our children in an integrated community. I must tell you that it was very good economically, because of the landlords not wanting to rent the blacks, you would come and get the place. It was fabulous that you could under ordinary circumstances. And that sense, and that our children, became. I remember when my daughter was in, my oldest daughter, living daughter, was in Doty school. And she came home and she said, there were three black children, all white. That's in that Boston, Chicago area. She came home and she made some comment that essentially was she was repeating racist observations. And she indicated that she was going, if this kid give her any more lips, she'd beat her up, or something. We descended on her like a ton of bricks. And we told her, you're not going to join. You're not going to be part of the lynch mob. You're going to have to help to put that out. A number of years later, we were staying in she was going to school in a school that was all black, or pretty much. She was a minority, maybe 10% were white. And she got into some situations, and the kid came home crying, got beat up on us. I said, why didn't you fight? And she said, you told me that. I said, listen, when you're the minority, pick up a stick or anything, don't ever submit. And of course, she taught at Ford High School, she taught at Northwestern, she's become, a very strong, she and her children and the whole family have become very strong advocates of equality against racism. But also, that incident about Paul Robeson, I remember, Reverend Hill had come to some of us in the labor movement and suggested during the Korean War that we organize a delegation to, there was a rally against the war in Chicago. And he suggested that we try to get a labor delegation. And we were influential in getting 700 delegates from Detroit, a lot of them from the Ford local and other locals, UAW locals, to go to Chicago and attend that peace rally. And while I was there, with the delegation, Dr. Dubois was presiding over that. There were 10,000 people in Coliseum in Chicago. And Dr. Dubois was presiding, and he called me up from the audience. down and I sat by side Paul Rose. We got to talk, and subsequently he came to Detroit for a concert, and I had fallen off a scaffold and was babysitting with the kids when while my wife was working, and I got a phone call one day, and it was Paul Rose, and he asked me if I could come down to the book and he'd like to spend some time. So I said, well, I'm babysitting, and he said, by all means, bring the two. So we went down to the book, and Brother Brown, his accompanist, was, and he was, you know, doing his thing. And he asked us to, you know, if we wait until he got through with his concert. And then he regaled us with, because he knew my Irish background, and Paul had spent a year in Dublin, and was tremendously impressed. And, you know, he told me stories like when John McCormick, the great Irish tenor, and he were great friends. And he said, because I asked him, did you know John McCormick? And oh, he said, I must tell you, I outdrew John McCormick in a concert on the same night in Dublin. And, you know, he told us how it happened. There were three or four seats more in the hall that Paul sang in the room. But he never let John McCormick off the hook on that room in his own town. And he regaled us with some Irish songs, and he was such a huge and gentle man, you know, and there was no pomposity or braggadocio or anything. Even that story, you know, he told, you know, and you had to laugh the way he denigrated himself, you know, in the situation. It wasn't intended to outshine McCormick or anything. But those were, it was. Coupled with the fact that I was married, the mother of my children was one of the few people who almost, and I have great trouble, but she trying to figure out how it was, that she seemed to be devoid of, biases and prejudice. Everybody she took for what they were.
She never started with any.
That's right. Right. And I could never quite fathom that. And that's, been imparted to the children and the grandchildren and the whole thing. So that in that sense. But I think, that the trade union movement and those people that formed the Progressive Party, because I want to tell you one other incident that occurred. I wanted to go to a peace conference in New York, and I was very dependent upon a young man by the name of Chuck Nickerman, who was, everybody said was a YCL, young communist league. He was brilliant because we would hold meetings, of issues in the shop, and we would have chaos. And this young man would stand up and with a solution to the problem. You could hear a pin drop when he began to speak. And I found myself wanting to emulate him, though he didn't. I had leadership role, he was stay with the people in New York I sent you to, and that you read the book Jews Without Money by Mike Grohl, and okay, anything to get to this conference, for a lot of reasons that weren't proper, but I went there, and lo and behold, it was an interracial couple, Jewish woman, black man, and in the Lower East Side of New York were 2 million Jews. This is back in the 40s. No, it's even, yeah, in the early 40s. And and I stayed with them. And that man had an enormous impact on me, too, because that, too, you know, was a step like yours in me to, I was overwhelmed when I couldn't believe it, you know, and it was really something, but my relationship with him from then on that lasted for a good number of years was very, very helpful in understanding more and more deeply. And all of this led to reading literature of black novelists, and Dr. Du Bois, Souls, black folks, Souls of Life, black folks, and a lot of other things. So, you know, this is part of it, but the struggles here. Remember, we used to have those, out the 4th of July thing.
Yeah.
I think we raised $1,500 that enabled me to open an office. And then I, you know, I was able to get support from the Teamsters and others.
We haven't covered the, you know, the really hot era of civil rights, the 50s. And, you know, sit-ins and restaurants, people sitting in restaurants, and were any of you involved in those kinds of things, or in the freedom marches and so on?
Well, I can remember, everyone remembers the march down Woodward when Martin Luther King was here, and everyone remembers the march on Washington, but there was another march right here in this area, and my memory, it was somewhere around 62, 63. This was the march down Michigan Avenue in Dearborn. Mm-hmm. And I participated in that, and I've never been so frightened in all of my life. I did not participate in any of the marches in the South, but I felt like most, you know, this was a time of war. And
how did that come about? I've read a little bit about it, and I was rather surprised because I'd never heard of it.
I think that was all part of the NAACP strategy for taking people out to have confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
I remember participating in a march in Plymouth.
Okay. Yeah, weren't there, I think there was some in Grosse Pointe also. I think they were in a number of suburbs.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, the issue centered around housing. I remember the ones in the Grosse Pointe. I don't recall the one in Plymouth, but I do remember being extremely frightened, marching down Woodward, and the eggs being thrown at us, and the oranges and the fruit, and, you know, you niggers, get out of here, we don't want you, and it was a very tense situation.
How long was the march?
Well, it was, I think it started somewhere around Schaefer,
mm-hmm.
on Michigan Avenue, mm-hmm. or maybe even near the City Hall,
mm-hmm.
There. Hubbard was
this.
Yes,
that's where the City Hall
is. Yeah, Schaefer, yeah, Schaefer,
yeah,
is right.
So it was right about there, and Hubbard was still the reigning
mm-hmm.
monarch.
He was the symbol of hold the line, I mean, because his whole reputation was premised on keeping blacks out of Dearborn.
Yeah.
He was mayor of Dearborn 40 years.
Yeah, he was more like a king of Dearborn and royalty. And it was a very nasty, volatile situation, equal to anything that I saw or had seen on television in terms of some of the marches in the South. Cicero, it was reminiscent of Cicero in Illinois, but the same type of bitterness, the same type of hostility, just gross hostility.
What were the numbers of, you know, numbers of marchers, numbers of people watching, and
you know, it's hard to remember. The number 200 sticks in my mind in terms of marchers.
So that's really not a lot.
No, it was not a. It was not a lot. I mean, we.
So I mean, that could be real scary.
Well, it was scary. It was scary.
When you don't know whether you really have the protection of the police department,
right.
And you don't have any idea what these onlookers are.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking or planning, you know,
mm-hmm.
You have to have a march, you know, requires a lot of elements that provide safety and security. But it was heroic in a sense because this virus hate had to be confronted in these suburban settings. It had to understand that race wasn't just something that happened in the city of Detroit. That people had a right to be free in their choices of housing, and so I believe it was the NAACP that was the.
Yeah, I don't recall the. I remember it centered around housing and
right.
Very very bitter, people that had very very hostile attitudes toward the march, but it was a good experience for me, and I. Sort of felt that I had an obligation to participate, not in the safety of the, and certainly it was a tremendous day when Martin Luther King marched down Woodward with Mayor Kavanaugh and all the rest, but some of us felt we had to do more than that. We had to go to the front lines to march and to show our support for our brothers and sisters in the South, and that came as close as I ever had the experience in terms of confronting the ugliness and the terror of racism here. It was more subtle in Detroit. We knew we couldn't, as a kid, we couldn't go to this place, and there were restrictions in terms of restaurants and hotels, but that was just the epitome of racism in terms of being very aggressive and very hostile with the name calling. Physical contact that occurred, some shoving and pushing occurred, but we were taught, we were very well disciplined. I was marching, I think my friend Leon Lucas was with me, and we were sort of locked arm in arm, and I can remember getting home that night and breathing a sigh of relief, having survived that particular experience.
When you were marching, were people singing, or?
Well, I think
was it just a silent march? Were you carrying signs?
Well, we had signs. I know I did not personally have a sign. I remember there were some signs, and there was, you know, the traditional song, "We Shall Overcome," which was that was a terrible song to the ears of some of the folks who lined Michigan Avenue that day, but. It helped keep us in line and gave us strength to endure that. My first attitude was to strike out and hit someone and really get into an altercation and really get into a street fight. But that wasn't our purpose. That was not the issue that day. It's interesting that later on I only encountered Orville Hubbard one other time, and that was at the funeral of a county commissioner when I served on the county commission. He was by that time in a wheelchair and was unable to speak. And then, as history has it, I ended up voting for his granddaughter to serve as a county commissioner 30 years after that particular march. So it's a history has a way of.
He was quite a fabulous politician. You know, since I've been raised in Durban, and went through scouting and that sort of thing. When we needed a car or transportation to drive a group of scouts up to the Upper Peninsula, because we were going to go to Isle Royale as a camp on the hammock, he provided the car and stuff like that. And as it happened, I drove his car, you know. And years later, I ran into him at Wayne University, and he called me by name. I mean, fantastic. I mean, that rascal, you know.
That he was a rascal.
Yeah, he was.
No question.
Quite a politician.
Yeah.
But the period of the marches was important. Even the marches in Detroit, you know.
There were a lot of early marches, the Willie McGee incident, you know, all before your time, but you must remember.
I don't remember that. No.
We had a march, but that was an exceedingly silent march. It was on a Sunday, and we insisted that people, you know, be discreet and proper in their dress. We did not want to, there was no singing or anything else. It was a mournful march. William McGee was framed on the rape charges. Do you remember the issue of the William McGee case? Mississippi. He was electrocuted, murdered by the state after a long and bitter struggle. But there were these kind of Scottsboro boys and there were seven in West Virginia, and all of these were those issues that, you know, began to focus on this issue, force people to examine, force people to come to terms, and that led to, ultimately, a lot of people forget that there were, you know, all of these incidents that occurred. I remember going to a veterans thing in Washington, and there were six of us in the car. Two were black. And we went to a restaurant in Maryland on our way into Washington, down around Hagerstown or Fredericksburg or one of those places. And it was just a roadside truck stop or whatever. We went in, and they wouldn't serve. They wouldn't serve. And we had a hell of a fight in that restaurant over that. And we were on our way to Washington, a veterans again. And they just would not. And it wasn't, and of course, we were up from out of town, and there was really no way we could get any allies in that piece. But that's the kind of thing. I remember when a woman by the name of Claudia Jones was here for a meeting at the Masonic Temple, and I was asked to see to it that she was taken to lunch. And I took her to Greenfields on Woodward. And, well, talk about a bit. I insisted that she go in front of me, and we forced the damn issue, and there was all kinds of growling and carrying on, but running around, they were, God, you'd never seen anything like it. But we sat and ate.
What year was that?
Oh, it's probably in the 40s, because Claudia Jones was deported. She was a Jamaican, and she was deported to England under the McCarran Act, the immigration, because she was alleged to be a danger to the country.
she wanted to eat a green grape.
Well, every one of these spots were, you know, it's just like a military operation. I mean, it was a holding point, and Greenfields held the line, and for everybody else, held the line, and it had to be taken one by one. The significance of the period of marches was that a certain balance of power in the country was shifting. You know, I mean, it was very clear that there was common cause in the civil rights struggle. I mean, you had all the religious denominations that had, up to that point, you know, and never really joined the battle. They joined with King, you had major Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, the Union movement, and it just involved up to its ears with money and personnel. It was a fantastic period because it represented the time that, you know, something changed in the country. So all these battles that we were having individually with this restaurant and that restaurant, can we cross, you know, can you cross Woodward Avenue, you know, for housing and that sort of thing. Those battles, something to, you know,
it's the
formulation changed then when we finally began getting national legislation, where there were, you know, some forces in the country just realized that you cannot have a national transportation system and exclude some people. You just can't do that. You can't have a black child wanting a Coke or a hamburger and he can't get it, and his father can't get it, you know, or these groups that are traveling, you know, you can't have that kind of conflict going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, you have a place like Joe Mirrors right here in the city of Detroit. And again, we lived right behind Joe Mirrors. My father could not go in. I remember one day he went over to Joe Mirrors, and the only way he could get fish, they would wrap it up in a newspaper and serve it to him out the back door. Every time I go into Joe Mirrors today for a business meeting, I that memory sticks vividly in my mind. As a matter of fact, I told one of his sisters, I said, you know, it was a time in my... Your family would not serve my family. It was wrapped up in newspaper. But you know, the marches in the 60s and that whole era was in part, I believe, precipitated by some other events. Just as we see a resurgence in freedom around the world today with Nelson Mandela being released from the Union of South Africa, and the Eastern countries at that time were in the height of their slavery. The African countries were actually being liberated. Ghana gained its freedom in the late 50s, and one African country after another became free of colonial rule. And I believe that was a source, not the only source, but certainly one source of inspiration to people here in this country, that we had our own form of apartheid, not in the South, but also right here in the city of Detroit, and that's a point that could be lost to history. That we were every bit as segregated in the 40s and early 50s, and of course going beyond that, but that's within my lifetime, as many of the Africans are in Cape Town and in some of the other cities in the Union of South Africa today in 1990. Mm-hmm. Detroit was certainly not an arsenal of democracy as it was touted to be, at least from a social standpoint it was, and it was from a war footing, from a production standpoint. But I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave.
Can we do something with you later?
Yep. Yeah, and there are going to be a number of other kinds of groups, and you're probably listed on other topics, and I'm going to make sure that everybody gets to say everything they want to say somehow.
Okay, thank you.
This was...
Thank you for coming.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much. We'll see you.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Trade union leadership, like myself, came to a realization in a rather protracted, hassle with ourselves, and to divest ourselves of all the background. It's most people assume that the trade unions, while they had the many of them had constitutional provisions that actually bar blacks. The more recent, in my time, the founding of the CIO broke from that pattern. But the people didn't become liberated overnight from their backward ideology. And so, if you look at the proceedings of conventions of the UAW, for example, who's perceived as the model, for with an FEPC, they were the first to do that, etc. But I can remember in the early days in the conventions when the slogan of the leadership was, including Walter Ruther, he was the most adamant on the question that we are not going to have discrimination in reverse. The very thing now that the Bushes and the others, on the question of quotas and that sort of thing. We were, some of us who became enlightened earlier on, not because we were, smarter or anything, only because we had a set of experiences that led us to the conclusions. There are brilliant people that are still hung up with this thing, so
yeah.
Smart.
Well, maybe wiser.
It's actually experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the kind of experiences that impact on you, and you have a good grounding in values, then it's inevitable if you have the right kind of experiences that you grow and develop in any area.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. We'll see you another time.
Hopefully.
I have you on the list for unions.
Yeah, good. That's really my expertise. That's what I do.
Okay, thanks.